I much prefer to be out, you know, pulling something, feeding an animal, or helping an animal giving birth, or just, you know, I'd rather be building a fence than sitting in an office meeting. But that's just me.
When Barbara Schaefer was laid off from her job as an environmental policy advisor, she took up a whole new career, saving a heritage breed of large black pigs. I'm Samantha Brown. You're listening to the Nature Stories podcast. This podcast is curated by Atlantic Public Media in collaboration with the Nature Conservancy and the Public Radio Exchange. Each week, we bring you stories about the intersection of people and place. Up now, Philosophy of Pig, produced by Neil Morrison with the Canadian Broadcasting Corporation.
Hello, what are you doing? What are you doing?
Oh,
what are you doing?
Oh, you're crazy.
I was clean this morning. I was perfectly clean. I haven't been clean since I started this job.
Around Barbara Schaefer right now, there are about 10 large black pigs. That's the name of the breed, the large black pig.
Hello. How are you?
Some of these are small, something bigger than a piglet. Others are enormous. Like what, 150 kilograms? 175 kilograms? Anyway, these pigs are rubbing up against Barbara and snuffling around her leg. But if you look up and out across the field, this is where your eyes play a trick on you. Out in the distance, but not too far, there are these hulking black animals moving like a herd. Your first thought is cows, because cows grazing in a pasture makes sense. But they're not. They're pigs. And when they see Barbara, a bunch of them begin lumbering towards her.
What you got?
Roots and dirt. Oh, it doesn't get any better than that.
I'm looking at one pig. She's about 6 months old, so she's still got 4 months here on the farm before she goes to slaughter. And she probably weighs about 180 to 200 pounds. She's got a very long back. She's got extremely strong, large shoulders and a long, long neck.
Here's what you need to know about the large black pig. The breed is about 200 years old, but versions of it go back much longer than that. It's gentle. It's huge.
Nice rounded backside.
It makes great bacon and ham. It used to be popular, but it grows too slowly for factory farms. And so now, it's endangered.
Pigs are extremely social. If you separate one pig from the herd, they get very upset.
What is that? Look at that beautiful... Is that a hawk?
Probably a hawk. Yeah, well, is that or a turkey vulture?
Isn't that a crow?
We see this a lot. They can't pick up the big... They can't get these. But they could get the piglets.
Really?
Yeah. That's why I like to leave them in the barn until they're a week old, because then they get heavy enough that I don't have to worry about the hawks picking them up.
Now that's real old school farming worry, isn't it?
Yeah, definitely.
The farm is old school.
Do you see those huts over there?
Yeah.
We built those out of old hay bales that no one wanted anymore. And we put two...
makeshift shelters, simple stalls of wood and straw and doors that don't hang straight. It's an old farm in need of updating. Barbara, though, is new to farming. Very new. Less than 3 years ago, she was an environmental policy advisor in Ottawa. Then one day, she was laid off. What were you wearing that last day?
Man, probably dress pants, dress sweater, heels, something really uncomfortable.
And what are you wearing today?
Oh, man. Sweatpants, oil rig boots covered in grain and mud, and a $9 shirt that I got from TSC that's supposed to be for a farmer boy. Size small. I'm not a desk person. I'm hyper. I like to be doing something physically active all the time, even though I'm very well educated and I'm completely capable of doing fairly large research projects. I much prefer to be out, you know, pulling something, feeding an animal, or helping an animal giving birth, or just, you know, I'd rather be building a fence than sitting in an office meeting. But that's just me.
First days on any new job can be tough, but few start like this.
Yes. We drove on a Saturday, stayed over.
Barbara's began with a 9-hour drive to pick up a load. Her very first load of pregnant pigs.
Now, we had been led to believe that they weren't as bred as they in fact were, meaning that they weren't so close to giving birth. And we figured they'd be safe enough traveling the 9 hours home. I'd done all kinds of book research, you know, talked to people, but it's much different when you're staring face to face, you know, the 400-pound animal with a belly full of babies. Our first clue that we were in trouble should have been when we saw a bunch of other pigs nursing on one of the pigs we were picking up, meaning that she had milk flowing.
And that's a big problem.
Now we know that that means they're about to give birth. Our great surprise, of course, was when we got them home 9 hours later, and it was nighttime. It was a November. It was cold and dark, and we opened the gate to the U-Haul, and none of the pigs came out. And everything changed because we suddenly heard this mew, mew, mew. It sounded like a cat.
But of course it wasn't.
And I thought, oh no, somebody's given birth in there.
Someone did. 6 piglets had been born. 1 died.
We rushed the 5 that are alive into the house in a recycling bin and put them in the warm kitchen. And we tried to get these big pigs into their rooms, and they didn't want to get off the truck, and they were afraid, and we were afraid of them because we had no idea what to expect. We were in a panic. We didn't know if there were more pigs in there. We couldn't see. We didn't know if the mother had finished birthing or if she was halfway through birthing. As it happened, she had another 8 pigs after that, but it was 36 hours later, and that's not supposed to happen. They're supposed to have them every 10 to 15 minutes once they get going. So everything was an absolute mess. And on top of all of that, Pinky, who you've met, suddenly we hear commotion in her stall, and she goes into labor. That was the night I met John Ashby.
John Ashby, farmer, neighbor, soon to be friend and teacher.
So we gave him a call at 10 o'clock at night, and here he is, a Sunday night. He was probably just about to go to bed, and he came over. And he stayed up with us till 1:30 in the morning helping us out. He showed us how to handle the pigs. He showed us how to rub their bellies to get them to lie down to nurse. He was incredible. He just was able to calm down the whole situation and take us 2 idiots who didn't know anything about pigs and make it all good. Oh, hi, John.
John, how long were you farming pigs?
Well, I've grown up with pigs my whole life. My father had pigs before I did, so, you know, well over 40 years, I guess, I've been involved in pigs in one way or another. Now she's talking to her. Now she's going to roll over, so, because I'm just going to go like this.
In front of us, an enormous sow lies on her side. 14 piglets scramble for the teats. John grabs the smallest one like it's a farm cat. Brings it to the last teat by the pig's hind leg.
That's where she needs to be.
At the end?
Mm-hmm. Why?
Because those are the 2 hardest to find, and that's where your smallest pig, your weakest pig, will always end up. And the 2 that are hardest to find. The big pigs will dominate the others.
And John continues to help Barbara.
I was doing this with Pinky, and she was in labor for a very long time, and I was very concerned because she looked like she was in distress. And so I called John, as I often did in those days, and said, John, what's going on? What's wrong? And he says, I'll be right over. He says, what you need is antibacterial soap, and you've got to wash yourself right on up to the elbow. He thought it was pretty funny.
Not funny from a wrong way,
funny from the fact that somebody who had never farmed before, at that point I had, 3 months experience or something, or no, I guess a bit more than that, but I really was still very new.
But the reality is, Neil, is she's come a long way from the first night I met her.
Really?
That panic.
There's not a lot of people would do this, you know, to make a change like that. It would be so daunting that they just wouldn't take it on, but she's a brave soul.
The pivotal moment for me was probably when one of our 18-year-old farm workers who had come to help put up a building the first winter that we had the pigs, this guy would look at me and he'd say, "You will never be a farmer." Well, don't ever say that to me, because as soon as somebody tells me I can't do something, that is the time where I reevaluate everything and I think, is that true? And I go, no way is that true. Not only can I be a farmer, I am a farmer.
It seems like a big shift. A policy analyst turned farmer.
You know, the practical application of everything that I have done and learned over the last 25 years is all right here on this farm. Minus the manure shoveling. But wait a minute, no, that's pretty much what I was doing before too.
And from an environmental perspective, compare your feeling. I just got that. Compare your feeling of it, of the value of the work you were doing before to the value of the work you're doing now in terms of protecting something.
I'd have to say what I was doing before had a certain value, but it's nothing compared to what I'm doing now.
So for Barbara, the shift is less dramatic. Still saving the environment, but instead of writing about it, she's doing it. But here's where I come in. Is this saving the environment? I have trouble answering this question. Take the Harlequin duck, for example. It's wild. It's endangered in Canada. It's easy to imagine that saving it matters. But how about a domestic breed of duck? Or the large black pig? Why does it matter?
The need for having this breed is not here anymore. This breed was to work on small farms such as this, to clean up the pastures, to clean up the orchards, to clean up after the family's meals, to clean up after harvest. They served a great purpose, and then, of course, they were delicious to eat later on.
And so this is where the questions start to build for me. If I'm honest, to me, it does feel like it matters. And not just because the concerns around food security. But the simple logic is that farm animals are not wild animals. They exist to serve a purpose. When that purpose expires, what's lost if we let the breed expire with it? It's logical. But there's a part of me that says, yeah, but... And this is where I find Karen Houle is very helpful.
If we looked at them and we saw them not as, you know, fungible units of meat...
Karen Houle is a philosopher at the University of Guelph.
If we looked at them as thousands and thousands of years of shaping each other's lives... That the loss of one of those strands is the loss of human history as well. I think of that as a kind of basic wrong, like an abandoning of something that forever has been part of what has enabled us to thrive and be well. We've had a long, rich, complex partnership with these breeds. We wouldn't be here and doing so well if it weren't for them. And probably vice versa. I don't think it just goes one way. So now at this point in time, they could be replaced. We could have cheaper meat. We could have faster cows. We could have horses that don't need so much, whatever. And for us at this point to say, okay, they're useless or they're replaceable, as I said, fungible, is to miss something about what those relationships are and what they entail. They don't entail just seeing them as useful or useless. So then just to reduce everything at some vulnerable point in their lives to a question of cost and cost saving is, it's a strong word, but I'm going to say there's a kind of obscenity to that.
So they eat roots, they eat dirt, they eat grass, they'll eat the weeds, pretty much anything. They like grubs and worms.
And when you're in the barn with John and Barbara, you get glimpses of a deeper loss. As we lose breeds like this that don't do well in big factory farms, we lose knowledge. John is the last of the line in his family. When he leaves farming, all his knowledge goes with him.
I'm third generation on the farm, and it looks like I will be the last. So my son at this point in time, who's 25 years old, is not showing us any interest in farming. So it's kind of sad to kind of know you're at the end of the line, but I'm going to do it as long as I can.
And now you're helping out with another generation of farmer here.
Well, I've started a few. I've started a few over my career. Not all of them have been successful, but many of them have. So, well, it's good to pass what knowledge you have on to somebody. I mean, if you don't have somebody in your own family that wants to absorb it, then it's nice to know that somebody like Barbara will at least glean some off of what I know. And
that knowledge is disappearing. Over here is a pen called the sick bay.
Guys here, they're in sick bay. Oh, hi, Wendy. Because they're not growing fast enough, and this one has a little abscess underneath here.
Under where?
Right on his penis. Turn around.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, I don't know what it is. And try and find a pig vet. Forget it. There's nobody around.
What do you mean? Why not?
Because there's no small pig farmers anymore, and the big, you know, the large pig farmers have their own people who work exclusively for them. But these guys are just not growing. These four pigs here, that one is 6 months old.
You're joking.
No, they're just not growing, and I don't know why. So I may have to, you know, go farther afield to find a pig vet.
It seems incredible to me that you have gotten help in all the different ways that you've gotten help, mm-hmm. and yet no one can help you to find a pig vet.
No. I actually contacted somebody at the University of Guelph who specializes in swine, not at the Kempfel campus, but out in Guelph. And he wasn't really able to help me too much either. No, so...
It's such a great example of what I was saying before, is the fates of humans and the fates of animals are entwined. And the fates of farmers are entwined with the fates of these breeds.
How would she be about me getting near them, okay?
Yep.
Yep.
Go for it.
And here, in another pen, another sow. Piglets piled in a bundle.
Just go slow and go down, and you can actually reach out and touch one. It's okay, Oreo. She's not sure.
Sure. She's a good mom.
She's a very good mommy. Mm-hmm.
Hi. Hello, Joshua. I want your baby. You want your belly rubbed? Would you like your belly rubbed?
I never get sick of this, ever. Every birth is wonderful.
This is a touching scene. It's not sentimental. These pigs are going to be eaten. They need to be eaten for Barbara to be able to support her family and for the breed to survive. But this is about more than just numbers. This is a kind of love.
How are your babies today, honey? You good? Yeah?
Yeah. We have to be brave and admit that that's true. Rather than engage in a kind of rational homo economicus policy speak, or as you say, get out the Excel spreadsheets. That's not that that's irrelevant. It does matter. But it's not everything that matters. And everyone knows that. As long as you've got a heart ticking in your body. So I think we have to be brave and keep that feature of us, which is not homo economicus, in the room, in circulation, in part of the story.
So my question was, does it matter if these farm breeds go extinct? If it happens, it will come at a cost to our knowledge and to our shared heritage. But how much does that matter?
That piece comes from Neil Morrison with the Canadian Broadcasting Corporation. To hear more stories like this one, stop by the Public Radio Exchange at prx.org. The Nature Conservancy provides support for this podcast, online at nature.org/stories, committed to protecting nature and preserving life. If you have thoughts or feedback, please write to us at podcast@tnc.org. I'm Samantha Brown in Woods Hole, Massachusetts. Join us next week for a brand new Nature Stories podcast.